now 45 minutes, right? Like trying to think about things that I think, you know, are realistic and real things that, that I think people can take home and use that information quite well.
Do you have, I mean, you're a lover of a whiteboard. I'm a chalkboard man.
I mean, chalkboard's got like that whole texture, hasn't it? And it feels, it's like the idea of holding a book compared to a Kindle. I definitely feel better. But
yeah, I've got a chalkboard painted wall. That's a mouthful in my flat.
A chalkboard painted wall. Yeah, that's amazing. Like, do you use it?
Loads, tons. I have it. So in my flat, basically the living room and the kitchen is like knocked through into one space almost. But yeah, there's two like fins on it, which I couldn't knock through because of the structure.
Yeah,
and I don't want the flat above me to fall into mine. So, exactly. So one of the fins on both sides is chalkboard paint.
That's cool.
So one side is like in the living room area and one side's in the kitchen. And I quite often write stuff on the kitchen stuff. Ironically, prime example, what my calorie intake is for the day.
Yeah.
So that I remember it. or like I use it. And then the one that's like the other side has got like my like dining room table on it next to it. So I quite often like, well, if I'm working, because when I'm working at home, I otherwise work at my desk, which is in the window, which looks out to Shoreditch with all the hipsters. Or I work at that that table and use the wall to write on like notes and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I'm similar. Like I've got three whiteboards in my room and it's just nice to like, or you know, brainstorm, isn't it? Just like I just chuck my ideas onto them and just leave them there and mull over them and things like this, to-do lists as well, personal goals, like things that I call like non-negotiables, which are like things that I need to do every day, you know, before that day is over. And that just keeps me doing things.
What's like an example of a non-negotiable for you then?
So at the moment, like it's doing like rehab, like spending time to also do some nose breathing meditation stuff. It was to do read a paper a day as well, which I'm still there. I just do it anyway now. So I read a scientific paper a day just so I'm constantly like learning and moving forwards. And they're the only ones I have at the moment. I'm adding actually on like tracking my calories again, because I wasn't tracking for quite a long time because I had no real reason. But now I want to again. So adding that to it. And it's just,
you need to have like a mental break from it, don't you? Because it's like quite, it takes a lot. I find anyway that if I get like obsessed with it, if I do it too much.
Yeah, completely. I agree. I don't think, but the whole, you know, the thing that we always said at the beginning and we've mentioned a few times through our time together is like tracking's super useful for one, obviously adhering to like specific goals and targets for a goal in particular, but also when you're new to it, it gives you context of food. It lets you know how many calories are in things, how many grams of carbohydrate, protein, and fat are in things. Otherwise you have no idea. Like calories in itself still isn't the be all and end all. And getting those ratios right is really what makes a difference in, you know, how you lose fat over muscle and things like this. And actually getting an understanding of food is so important for your ability to know how to eat long term. And, you know, I recommend for people that don't even want to like lose weight or anything like this, if you did 3 months of tracking your calories and actually get an idea about what's in food, you know, your ability to maintain your weight or so on in the future is so much greater.
Yeah, it's just like, I feel like I learned a lot. I have learned a lot from it and still learning a lot from it.
Yeah.
I think that, it's the big one for me always was as a, and it kind of still is, as a vegetarian, it was protein. It's always been protein.
Yeah.
Like, it would have been harder if I was vegan, definitely.
For sure.
But there's still obviously ways around it. Like I love yogurt. And my second favorite love is protein ice cream. Like, two great loves.
I love protein ice cream as well.
And do you know what I did the other night? You'll be proud of me. Frozen fruit and yogurt all blended up. Oh,
yeah, it goes super creamy, right?
Oh, did it with raspberries, frozen raspberries, yeah. And some yogurt.
I'm a big fan of that. Frozen raspberries and like yogurt. Or you could do it with like whey protein powders or things like this. It goes into like a sorbet consistency. It's amazing, or like a froget, I guess in your case.
So I've started recording. I'm telling you now, you probably already noticed, but I'm just telling you so you know.
Yep.
So please feel free to swear as much as you want. Francis was like, I did one with Francis a while ago, and he was like, oh wait, I can swear on this. And I was like, fuck yeah, of course you can. You can say what you want. I don't care.
Yeah.
And so to let everyone know, on somewhere, you're still west, aren't you?
No, I'm north London, so I'm a bit further north than you. I'm on like the edge of London in Enfield.
I know why I thought you were west, because that's where we did that fucking disgusting science experiment you did on me.
Yeah. I mean, what were you on about? That was the best time ever. Who doesn't want to ride a 4-hour turbo with four ridiculous efforts?
And how much spikes and blood taking went
in? Quite a lot of blood taking. Yeah, we had what, just before the start and then before and after every effort. So 2, 4, 6, 8, like nine blood samples taken.
It's fucking horrible.
Yeah, it wasn't the best.
And over the course, was it two consecutive weekends? Or was it
two consecutive weekends. Yeah, so a week apart from each trial. And
it's fucking hard, that was.
Yeah, it's pretty surprisingly why I didn't get that many participants.
I mean, do you know what? What was kind of, I mean, the thing is, that was a couple of years ago, wasn't it now?
Yeah, it's 2017.
Jesus Christ. I've known you longer than I thought.
Yeah, it's blown by.
Yeah, and what, like, the bit that also interests me about that was now, 4 hours on the turbo, I'm just like, yeah, cool.
Yeah, I know, right?
It doesn't faze me. Like, and so many people ask me, how do you do it? And I'm like, well, it's just 4 hours. It's 24 hours in a day. It's just still a small proportion of the day. Like, it's not that bad.
Yeah. I think of it as just like, because I remember when I was training for my record, I had to do 100 miles on the turbo, and that was like, you know, 6 hours. I just think of it as like three films, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's how you break things down.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that bad. It really wasn't that, I mean, at the time it was bad, but now I would probably, to be honest, now if you were to do it, I'd be like, yeah, cool, let's do it.
Yeah. It's funny. I think too many people have this perception of turbo training just being like really hard, maybe like the chafing or the saddle sores or something like this. But I don't think that's necessary to everyone. I mean, you guys didn't get it. And I mean, Owen was an animal, absolute animal in that study. But like, you know, we just put a film on like, what's his name? I can't even remember. Lance Armstrong's documentary.
Yeah, we watched that, didn't we?
Yeah. But, I mean,
we watched like Gladiator or something as well.
Yeah, just like motivational movies. But
I think it was 300.
Yeah. I mean, and you obviously got to ride against George one weekend as well, didn't you?
No, I didn't. I didn't do any
of it with George. Oh, so yeah, George and Owen did it together.
Yeah, George and I did it together, and then I did it with Andy, the guy who does the stuff for Help for Heroes.
Yeah.
I did both of them with him because he did it on his Trek TT bike.
Yeah, and I think you also did it with a guy called Henry.
Yeah, and then there was another guy who you told him to stop doing the session.
Yeah, a guy called Cam. Like, I had a few people that like were like well up for it, but then couldn't do it.
Yeah,
you know, because
physically couldn't do it.
Yeah, physically couldn't do it because like it was tough. Like, it wasn't just 4 hours zone two, you know, it was at the 50 minute mark of each hour you had to ride at pretty much ventilatory threshold, you know, give like a 10 minute all-out effort. And then on the last one, it was a total time to exhaustion, like essentially replicating like a sprint finish in a road race. And you know, you riding as long as you could at threshold at the end of 4 hours, which is pretty hard.
You know? Most people lasted what, 5 minutes?
Yeah, it wasn't long. Yeah. Owen was disgusting though, because the first time he did it, he only did it for like 5 or 6 minutes. But then the second time he did it, I think he went for about like nine or ten, and he just like, oh yeah, destroyed it.
So for people to know, I don't think I actually said that this is Will Gerling on the other side of the line, who is nutritionist and for EF Pro Cycling.
Yep.
Previously has worked with, are you still allowed to work with like Camille and like the CCC guys?
Yeah. I was told I was allowed to still work with Camille. Obviously the season's not happened, so I'm not working with them at the moment.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So you've also worked with guys from CCC, from Drops.
Yeah.
You've worked with boxers, footballers.
I've done some football academy guys, yeah, from Derbyshire and Norwich.
Have I missed anything else off that list?
Yeah, I work with the Invictus Games, with the Paralympic athletes for GB. I work with some Commonwealth Games riders who got like a bronze and a silver at the Commonwealth Games. Work with Blaine Hunt, the Paralympic cyclist who got his British kilo number one, got the national jersey for that.
Yeah. And
should hopefully go to the Paralympic Games. As well.
And he lives on the other side of the park to me. Did you know?
Yeah. I was thinking he must be close because he lives in Shoreditch by you.
He looks way more hipster than me, though, doesn't he?
Huh?
He looks way more hipster than me.
Yeah, it does with his moustache for sure. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, he's a strong rider. Like he does the kilo in like literally like a minute, I think, or just under. He's like pretty much up there with like normal, un-Paralympic riders, you know.
Yeah, he's a beast, isn't he?
Mm, for sure.
And as I said, you're now working with EF. Well, obviously, I say working with, it's like you're on paper working with, but right now, bloody bike riding, you're kind of like not working with them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly.
It's weird, isn't it? And we've done a lot of stuff together over a series of years, as you might have heard from all that previously talking about Will basically taking my blood and making me ride really hard on the turbo trainer for 8 hours. And then we're just referencing one of our friends, Owen, who is like a fixed gear crit racer, turned kind of rides his bike anywhere, everywhere, turned baker, fuck me, his beard is ridiculous right now.
It looks amazing. He did a lap with the M25, you know.
Yeah,
it's like 225 miles or something like this. I was like, you crazy man.
He's such a geezer, isn't he? And he also looks like Mark Cavendish, which is quite funny.
He does.
He's taller though. He's taller than Cav.
Did you know that?
Yeah, he's taller than Cav. Yeah. I mean, Cav is tiny, but yeah, he's taller than Cav. And so I wanted to do this one with you for a multitude of different reasons. One of it was because you as a human being and being half Viking,
that's right.
Probably an extra in Game of Thrones, if not, should have been. Could also play, would be very good to play like mafia roles. I think you'd be pretty good for, you know, anyone who needs a bouncer kind of role, 300 style films, Game of Thrones style things. Those kind of things. Like, you need a big man to look menacing and scary. Will would be good, but he's not very menacing or scary. So,
more you act with the scars now, though. Like,
yeah, it adds to it, but still, you're not menacing or scary. It makes, I reckon if you didn't smile and just frown,
yeah, literally,
that would probably help. But I mean, there's a lot of you. You're a big lad. How tall are you?
6'4".
And how much are you weighing right now?
At the moment, I'm bang on 100 kilos.
100 kilos. And how much of that is henchness right now? You've been gymming it.
I have, yeah. It's probably, like, if I dropped maybe, like, 5 kilos, I'd be pretty lean. So
yeah, basically you're just a beast, aren't you?
trying.
You could, and you've done what's interesting about you is you've done your background in nutrition is really fascinating anyway. And is high on the geek factor, but also you come from powerlifting, like World Strongest Man style stuff, to getting on your bike and riding. And I think actually I'm just going to let you explain it, like a bit about your background and also what happened to you like a year or so ago.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you wanted to also know about like how I got into nutrition and things like this.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, training wise, it's a quicker and easier one. Originally, yeah, I was into just gym, and then got into strongman, competed in strongman, which is cool. So that's, you know, all the Atlas stones, tire flipping, you know, keg carrying kind of stuff, which is great fun. Did that, went up to like 117 kilos, I think I was. Lifting serious weight, which is fun. Did some powerlifting as well, though they weren't my strongest events. Better at picking things up and running with them, which is, you know, great fun. I think probably my best event was probably tire flips. You know, I think best I got was like a 300 kilo tire. I could flip that like 11 times in a minute.
Nice.
Something like that. But, and then obviously got into riding, you know, passion for riding, to touring countries is how I found that. And then obviously went on to try and break the world record for the length of Europe is what I did.
And what was the, and that was all going ahead very smoothly and very potentially, you would have probably broken it in all honesty at that time. You were ripping it on fitness. And then something very unfortunate happened, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Sadly, I had a collision with a lorry on my bike, and subsequently broke everything on like every appendage of my body.
How was the lorry?
Obviously destroyed and dented. It was a write-off for the lorry, you know.
Because obviously because of the scale of you versus the lorry, it would be like me running into one of those little kids' cars, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they said, though, like, the reason I survived was because of my size and things like this. It's pretty crazy.
I remember it happening because I was messaging you and I hadn't heard from you. And like, you're normally pretty quick at responding, I know that you have seen my messages, you know, normally on it. And I hadn't heard from you for quite a while. And I was thinking, this is weird. Like, and I kept like messaging, and then I spoke to George and I was like, have you heard from Will recently? And George actually was the person who spoke to your sister and told me. And I remember thinking, holy fuck. Like as a friend, it was really scary. I'd imagine equally for your family, it would have been incredibly scary as well. But your sister was, you know, she's amazing at keeping us all in the loop and just letting us know how you were getting on. And then messaged a couple of us saying you're going to come into town, and we went and
had Whole Foods.
You remember at Whole Foods, yeah. And that was the first time I saw you post the accident, and you were like, you're still obviously big, but you'd lost a lot of timber, and you still had your jaw wired up then.
Yeah, yeah. I went down, for me, I mean, obviously really light. I went to like 88 kilos, which is super light for me. I think I lost like just under 10 kilos in 2 weeks in hospital. And then I came in and saw you guys. I had my mouth wired shut for like 12 weeks. So yeah. I had like a liquid only diet for 12 weeks. It's pretty full on. Interesting experience.
I mean, needless to say, you know, you're an incredibly lucky person, and it's a very unfortunate incident, and we're all very thankful that you're all right. Like, I mean, fucking hell.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's mad. Like, I had a lot of people reach out to me as well, saying that, you know, the amount of accidents I've had, and, you know, this news about like £2 billion of infrastructure going into cycling, it is pretty good. There obviously needs to be a lot more awareness, because there is a lot of accidents happening, you know, in London, even like to Tim, you know, Swanee London, who had his one.
I think especially of recent time, I've done a large proportion of my training indoors, and I do normally anyway, like, you know, like I have no issues with like riding on the turbo, and the reason why I do that is because then it means that when I ride outside, I do it because I enjoy it.
Yeah,
it's like hard work's done inside, the fun is done outside. And basically, I think when I ride outside, I probably at least once a week, maybe more, have a moment where I think, flip me, that was close.
And I live
pretty central, and I don't know if it's worse or better outside of London, but
yeah, it's tough. It's like
better in Europe.
Yeah, you always kind of get those guys that are just turning left that just don't see you, and you like you have to put on your brakes a bit early or something like this. Yeah, I mean, it's super tough, like for a lot of riders out there. I think hopefully more people are becoming more aware of it, especially now more people are starting to ride because of the lockdown.
Yeah, definitely. Like through my 9-to-5 job, I'm noticing that from dealing with some of the clients that I'm working with, there's like the uplift is insane in new cyclists, and that's like new cyclists that are like researching things on the internet. Like, you know, obviously I've been looking into that side of it for some of the clients I work with, and like you can see that it's quadrupled, like the interest in cycling. You look at like things like Halfords, which was basically on the verge of going into administration, is now turning over profits.
I work with someone that works for Chain Reaction, and who are owned by Wiggle, I think it is, isn't it? And he's saying they're selling out of bikes.
Turbo trainers are sold out almost everywhere in the UK as well. Like,
Wahoo's made a massive profit, right?
And then you look at like, you know, Zwift, Ruvi, you know, Road Grand Tours, Trainer Road, all Trainer the Road, indoor training platforms. Like, they must be like, I mean, I know Zwift, it used to be on Zwift, basically on like a Saturday morning, for example, they might have between 1,000 and 3,000 users using it, and now it's like between 5,000 and 10,000 users using it.
Crazy,
which is nuts. It's absolutely nuts. But I mean, that's because people obviously are respecting the rules of lockdown. I mean, I know they've been kind of lifted a bit in the UK. Whether or not I agree with that is a conversation for another time. That probably answers my response on that one.
Definitely.
But then you look at like it's a good thing that people are consciously, you know, one, trying to keep fit and healthy, and two, looking at alternative options to help them with transport and getting around, basically. And as you say, hopefully it will widen the eyes of a lot of people who are looking at, who are drivers and cyclists. And I hate saying you're a driver, you're a cyclist, because in reality you're just a human being. Like, it doesn't matter when you drive, you know, whatever it is, there's no other like thing like where you would refer to someone as something else, like to dehumanize him.
Does
that make sense?
I get that.
It just seems to be in cycling that you are a cyclist, and that dehumanizes you as opposed to a person on a bike.
I get that.
Anyway, that was a rant.
We digress.
So one of the things that I get asked tons, and I'm not the right person, I don't have the knowledge, obviously. I don't have the qualifications to really explain it to the kind of level that you would, but I get asked so often, and I get a lot of messages as well, like private messages asking, how the hell do you fuel a 24-hour race?
Yeah.
So I thought the easiest thing to do would be to ask the guy that has fueled me twice in 24 hours. Yeah.
My favorite, both, man.
Both very successfully as well. Like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, the distance-wise and positioning. And did you know what? I hold the under 30 record now.
That's awesome, mate. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that. And then I got an award for it.
Oh, yeah. I remember you sending me actually that picture of you having an award.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I mean, it's definitely my favorite area of research, personally, like ultra endurance events, Audaxes, you know, 24-hour events, multi-day events. These are all the things that I really love looking at, you know, getting geeky about and looking into the research. And, you know, fueling for something like that is all about, it's all about practice and preparation more than anything. Mm. You know, for both of them, we had you practicing the amount of food, you know, riding. In the first one, we had you doing 4-hour stints and then coming in and then just refueling you and giving you a quick meal, of which, you know, I cooked for you. And the second time around, we did it without any real proper stops, didn't we? We kept you in a pit stop for like under a minute, I think, each time.
Yeah, I think the second time the total... The first time, the total stoppage time was like a good hour and a bit, I think. Maybe longer, maybe 2 hours. And then the second time, the total stoppage time was like 20 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty big difference. And, you know, when looking at fueling for an event like that, it's definitely that carb load the day before, which is going to be integral for something of that duration. And then, once again, coming back to that practice of what you're doing for that event, knowing how you're going to fuel it and what your availability is. So how much you're going to have per hour, working that out into how much food that is, and then the choices of those foods. And we had you sitting comfortably at around 60 to 80 grams an hour on the bike. The first time you did it, it was 60 grams an hour with then a big refeed every 4 hours, which is when you sat down for that meal. And then on the second time round, we aimed more for that 80 grams an hour throughout the whole event.
What's important to say is that takes practice in its own right.
Definitely, definitely. Like, and this is the thing I come across the most, is that people don't practice race day nutrition. They're so involved into trying fasted training, keto, all these different things, where they're not really approaching it in the right sense of, what am I going to do race day? Oh, I'm going to do this. That's what I should practice. You know, and getting used to taking on 80, 90 grams of carbohydrates an hour consistently over hours is something that's quite challenging. And definitely one of the things that I thought about after the second 24 was, like, you got a little bit of GI distress. It wasn't a huge amount, but I noticed it was from the OnePro gels. And you know, doing some stuff with EF recently, and if you look at the pH value, so the acidity alkaline values of products out there, if a product is quite acidic, it can cause GI distress, whether acid reflux or not. So, you know, those products, like those, which I think it was like passion fruit and lime or something like this, and it's really derived from fruit, it's going to be quite acidic after quite a few hours. And this is the same thing with like lots of other commercially bought products with the flavorings in. If you're continuously having that gel or that drink over several hours, that acidity can really build up in your stomach and cause you to have, you know, reflux.
To simplify this for some people, what happened in the 24 was I threw up twice.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember you in particular not wanting those gels anymore. And, you know, that's something that even with practice, you can't really know, because you know, you're not going to go out there for a practice ride for 8 hours and continuously take that one gel. So that's something I think is also for people to be aware of, and they can take into their own mind, is that it's worthwhile knowing about that pH level of different things. And I think, you know, you're better off just going for neutral products now. So SIS have that beta fuel, which is unflavored. You've got Martin, which is also unflavored. Mm-hmm. You can even make your own energy drink, which is so cheap. It's unreal. I was chatting to Jimmy about it literally like 3 days ago. You know, you can buy a bag of maltodextrin, a 1 kilo bag of maltodextrin, which is the main carbohydrate component of pretty much all sports drinks and gels. And that'll cost you, I think on one site, it was like £3 for a kilo. And that's gram for gram carbohydrate. You know, so that's 1,000 grams of carbs for £3. And then it was, you can buy electrolyte powder as well. 500 grams was £2.50.
It's like a quarter of the price, isn't it?
Yeah, so like 1 gram, so you needed 2 grams to equate just over more than one tab that you'd get from a tube of electrolyte tabs. Mm-hmm. And you think about that, so you'd get 250 servings for £2.50.
Mm.
That's a penny a serving. You know, compared to, I think it's a penny serving.
It sounded good.
Yeah. Whereas you pay like, what is it, £7 to £10 for a tube of tabs. Now, you've just paid like, you know, £6, maybe £7 with postage and packaging for what will, you know, last you more than 50 bottles compared to, you know, other products. It's mad. It's mad the cost of some of these things.
Why do you think it's so expensive?
Oh, it's just branding products that, like, you look at the breakdown of some of these things, like, you know, standard, you know, energy drinks. It's just maltodextrin flavorings, probably some preservatives, something like this, some coloring, maybe. There might be some. It might be a glucose fructose mix, so using two different transports of and types of carbohydrate. But it's, you know, there's nothing special. They're just, you know, you're just charging a premium for it to be a product from them and so on.
You pay for the brand, don't you, at the end of the day, quite often.
Yeah, and also I think there's not much education about, or, you know, you can definitely go find it if you really go looking for it. But, you know, if you knew, if I said to you, oh, just buy a bag of maltodextrin, buy a bag of electrolyte, and then just, you know, 2 grams of electrolyte and, you know, whack in, I don't know, 20 to 60 grams of the maltodextrin into a drink, you've got yourself the same drink that you'd buy. Like, you'd be like, oh, shit, like, I'll do that. You know?
But that's where being a professional at what you do is, like, like, I look at the back of a package of pretty much fucking everything, and I'm like, yeah, cool. I know what one of the things is on that. Oh, wait, here's a good example. An apple. It's just an apple. Perfect. Yeah. Great. Then you look at, like, I don't know, jam is another example. Yeah?
Yeah.
It should be quite simple. There's loads of random ingredients and words. I look at it and I'm like, yeah, cool. Yeah, that all makes complete sense to me. No, not at all. Yeah,
there's a lot of added products, you know, whether it's emulsifiers and preservatives and things like this, stabilizers and so on. But yeah, one ingredient foods is definitely a way to go forwards. And I also, you know, coming back to your 24-hour thing, you know, if you're going to list it in the things that you need to do, it's, I can give a rundown of essentially the considerations for people doing something like that. So day before is carb load. Mm. And then morning of, 2 to 4 hours is a pre-race meal. Mm-hmm. 2 hours beforehand is nitrates and start hydrating. So you start in a euhydrated state. And then 1 hour beforehand is caffeine. 20 minutes beforehand is a small carbohydrate-based snack. And then upon beginning riding, you take your first bit of carbohydrate in really about 45 minutes to 60 minutes in. And then from that time on, you're pretty much doing your hourly target of 60 to 90 grams per hour for the remaining amount of time. Caffeine was repeated every 4 hours. Mm-hmm. So you had a large dose to begin with, and then you had smaller subsequent doses every 3 to 4 hours after that, and that's pretty much how it went. And then those elements were all practiced. We'd had you done a carb load before. We didn't need to practice that too much in the lead up for that because we knew what it works and what we did.
Yeah.
And, you know, for hydration wise, it was pretty much like a bottle an hour, which is pretty standard recommendation.
I was drinking more last year than I did the previous year as well, wasn't I?
Maybe. I can't remember which one was hotter.
I think that 2018 was definitely hotter towards the end.
Yeah.
Because I remember a guy chucking a sponge at me at the end of that one. And literally at the end, when you go past the start finish, a guy like launched a sponge at me and I just like squeezed it all over myself.
Yeah.
2019, I think it was still very warm towards the end and the finishing circuit.
Yeah, you definitely cook in those helmets as well.
Yeah, massively so. Like they, you know, I took the visor off, didn't I, for the 2019 towards the end. I was like, nah, I can't have this thing on me, it's steaming up. Yeah. And I think I rode from night time. I didn't wear the visor until, well, that was it. I took it off and left it off.
I mean, it's definitely given me an idea for one of my YouTube videos to do the TT setup.
Subscribe, like, follow Will Girling. Will Girling Nutrition on YouTube?
I think it's just Will Girling. If you YouTube search it, I'll come up.
Subscribe, like, follow, all that stuff. It's hyper interesting stuff.
Yeah.
And you get to look at a beautiful man with lovely locks as well, talking about stuff. it was interesting. What for me is the rider on those races, what was like, I am forever in debt to you and Jimmy every single time we do it because I couldn't do it without you two. And the reason for that is you took a hell of a lot of the stress and the thinking away from me.
Yeah.
And it meant all I had to, like all I had to do was think about the riding and concentrate on that, which sounds ridiculous when you say it, like, oh, I just had to think about cycling and turning my legs over. But it's like, you know, between you guys and then with Ken, my coach, like, no, all I had to think about was this was the wattage I needed to try and hit.
Yeah.
Because we had a tactic on the race was riding the first 4 hours hard.
Yeah.
Allowing the body to taper down and then trying to pick it up again towards the end. And that, I fell to pieces towards the end.
Yeah, you had a hard run up, I think, last year.
I got knocked off twice, ironically. Yeah.
And a few other bits. But I think that's what a lot of people can take value from. Getting yourself a nutritionist or something like this when you're training for an event is... it means you don't have to think about these things anymore. You hand it over to a professional who just tells you what to do. And, in my case, I feel like education and knowledge is a huge power in that reinforcing why you're doing stuff is really important because I think you then adhere to it a bit more and you understand why you're doing it. And obviously then you have that knowledge forever onwards. But, for that specific event, if you know that someone's got control of it or they've told you what to do, you just need to follow that and everything's going to be okay. And I've had similar things with in my TT that I did when George just told me what to ride at, and I just rode at it. And it does take away a lot of that thinking for yourself and worry. And me and Jimmy staying up all night and sorting your food out and whatever.
I know Jimmy said he'd never do it again, but I'll be honest with you, I'm pretty keen to go back and do it again.
Man, why would you do that to us? Why would you do that to us?
Well, you've seen the little snippets of my new TT bike.
I know. I mean, me and Jimmy were so tired last time as well. Well, not as much as you probably. But
I don't remember the last like 4 hours. I literally don't remember it. And I don't remember the subsequent maybe day.
I'm not surprised.
I couldn't tell you what happened from the moment that the last 4 hours, so at the finishing circuit, pretty much until the next day. I couldn't tell you. I don't remember any of it. Last year I personally get asked like quite a lot, is like, why do you do it? And it's always been about like trying to find that limit and then trying to push through it.
Yeah.
You know, what is my body physically capable of? And last year, I think, was the closest I've ever come to that. You know, I went into the race not in the perfect condition physically or mentally. You know, my back was in pieces at the end. Like, I couldn't sit on the bike. And that's been an issue that I've had to be managing pretty much from that race to very recently. On and off, as you know. That was because I got knocked off by a truck. And so, like, my head, like, I personally want to go back at some point. I don't know when. Because it's been cancelled this year anyway, and I never intended to do it this year, as we know. But it's been on my radar to keep, you know, I enjoy it. And as much as I think it, like, destroys all of us at the time, it's very, I look back on the memories of the races as some of the most positive memories I've ever had. And it's because, it like, for me, what was so special about it was that I have my mates there, and you guys have my back. Like, it sounds really, like, bit naff, but for me personally, like, that was a mega thing, you know, mega thing, and knowing that, you know, I had support from you guys, and I feel like, and personally, I feel like it made us all closer as friends.
I think touching on one of the points you said as well about challenging yourself and seeing what you can do, I think a lot of that was what I was trying to achieve in my record attempt, and also to fight stereotyping a lot as well. Which I know you're quite big on, and, you know, to make people change perceptions of what people can and can't do by, you know, purely looking at them.
I know you've got it quite a lot, didn't you, as a big guy? Like, people would look at you and go, oh, you're not a cyclist. People don't take into account the fact that, fuck me, this guy can put down some serious watts.
It's crazy. Like, you know, I remember being at the London bike show at the XL or whatever, and, like, Jimmy and Emily walking around with me and talking to people, you know, trying to get sponsorship and things like this, and the amount of, like, bike company owners and people who would say, oh, you're a bit big to ride, and, you know, continuously saying that to me, even within that one day, like, had an effect on me. And this is exactly why I wanted to do it, was because, you know, people make a, you know, a passing nonchalant kind of comment like that, oh, you're a bit big to ride, or whatever it might be to you as an individual. You know, if you repetitively hear that, you're too big for something, you're too small for something, you're not able-bodied enough to do something, you're a female, you're whatever, you know, just to do something. Like, if you keep hearing that, it's going to make you self-doubt yourself. It's going to make you, you know, not think you can do these things. And I think that's, you know, it's quite disgraceful, really, in some ways. And I think if you have passion and drive and want to do something, you should, you know, you should do it. And that's what a lot of it was. You know, I've always wanted to challenge myself and, you know, have a competitive background. And to have people telling me, more so that I couldn't, you know, do something, I was like, no, you'll see. I'll do that.
Prove them bitches wrong, innit?
Yeah, exactly, you know. And that was like, I mean, it's the funniest experience that I look back at really funny. I've only done one TT, but obviously because I did it like 2 weeks before my crash. But, you know, I went up to a 50-mile TT in Oxford, and I was there with my road bike, and, like, no disc wheel, no, like, big rims or anything. I think I only had a TT helmet that I borrowed from Jimmy, and the speed suit. And, like, I knocked out a sub 2 hour 50 mile. I think I got like an hour and 54 minutes. And on a roadie, and, like, but I remember the looks I was getting, like, on a road bike before.
Mate, you smashed it.
Yeah. And it was so funny, you know, just the judgment you get.
And like, time trialing is probably the least judgmental part of cycling as well, which is the funny part. Like, TT riders generally don't give a shit about anyone else. All they care about is their own race. That's my experience when I've done TTs.
I mean, they care about the kit, though, don't they?
Oh, Matt, yeah. So, I mean, yeah, you look at the gains. Hey, I mean, I'm prime example. I've got myself a set of freaking custom arm extensions coming for my new TT bike. So, and my old TT bike was custom painted. Like, I'm prime example, you know, complete number one target time trial customer. But of cycling. Like I've always thought time trialing is one of the best ways to get into cycling competitively.
Yeah, for probably sure. It's just against similar, itself.
Yeah, cyclocross as well is quite similar, but maybe not as... Cyclocross is probably not quite as easy to get into, but you know, you're limited by the type of bike you can ride. And while time trialing, you could literally turn up on your, you know, any bike. Admittedly, as you said yourself, some people get really snooty about it, but you don't need a special bike to do it, I think is my point.
Yeah. Agreed.
But yeah, you smashed it. Like, Jesus Christ. I remember it and I'm thinking, fuck me, that's quick.
Yeah.
Really quick.
I never cramped so much in my life. It was the hardest thing I'd ever done.
Oh man, I quite like a 50 and 100 mile TTs. I do. They're quite a good mental 25, 50 and 100 I quite like. I'd have liked to have done some more this year, but hey ho.
Yeah, I mean, it's looking hopeful I should get back on the bike, so we'll see what happens this year.
Yeah, definitely. So we've covered quite a lot already, and yeah, probably not covered some of the stuff I wanted to cover, but that's good, actually. I wanted to get from you a couple of like quick response ones, which is what I'd already informed you of this before. Mm. So I know you've already whiteboarded this.
Yeah.
Five mistakes made by cyclists.
Yeah. I love this one.
This is a good one that comes up quite a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. Like, so saving yourself for the post-ride binge was the first one I wrote. I think a lot of people do this. They go out on their bike, they do a big old ride, they don't fuel enough for it, and then that's either because they want to have a big meal afterwards, or they just don't fuel enough on it, and then they come back and they just hit that fridge. And I think everyone's probably done that at some point, but like, you know, people purposely do that, and the amount of calories you're going to consume when you're that hungry after the bike, and you know you're looking at it the wrong way in that you're not fueling that bike ride and doing it appropriately and getting the most out of it, and then also relating to some, you know, poor like nutritional habits afterwards, and you know, really just stuffing yourself with probably all the wrong food and kind of doing it in the backwards way, isn't it? Like, rather than fueling a good ride and then just coming back and feeling refreshed, because when you do feel properly, you get off the bike and you feel good. You still feel like you've got energy. But if you come back and you've done a, you know, poor fueling, you know, you come back and that fridge looks so much nicer.
Yeah. That's definitely one that I think a lot of people do.
And it's a big one as well when, like, if you're trying to drop body composition, lower your body fat levels, it makes it a lot harder because you're not going to track or know what you've had in that period of time. It's going to go in real easy. You're going to forget most of what it was, and it can easily be like 1,000 calories. You know, you can be surprised. Suddenly you come back and you're like, oh, I'll have that hot crust bun with butter on, and I'll have a bit of that and a bit of this. And you know, it's all gone. That's 1,000 calories. Easy. The next one I had was fuel for the work required, which is a saying I use a lot, and it kind of relates to the previous one a lot, in that, you know, fueling for that training session is the most important thing. You know, you need to get the most out of it. Like, that's why you're doing it, and you need to prepare your food to be able to get the best out of that ride and to perform your best, whether that's efforts or zone two long duration. And it kind of blends in with the third one as well, where, like, you know, too many people are wanting to do keto, fat adaption, fasted riding, but they're doing it for the wrong rides and the wrong reasons. I think you need to focus on what's the goal, why am I doing this ride in specific, and what is my ultimate goal? You know, what am I trying to achieve? Am I trying to do a 100-mile ride? Am I trying to do a 24-hour race? Am I trying to just do an Audax or maybe like some touring or something like this, or maybe even just road racing and crit racing? You know, fueling for those sessions, getting that right, getting the most out of them is the main point. And then, you know, keto fat adaptation and fasted riding is something that I think only more experienced riders need in the relation to like fasted riding for fat adaptation and so on. Because when you're first getting into riding, just ride. Like, consistency is everything.
Yeah, massively agree with you.
Like, you don't need to be playing around with fasted riding, with any of these things. You just need to go out, ride your bike, love it, and fuel yourself for it. You know, get through that ride, feel great about that ride, and do it again. You know, like keto, I've done so much research into keto, and there is not a single paper out there that says keto outperforms carbohydrate-based trials. Nowhere. And people still do it.
I just think it sounds like fucking grim.
Oh yeah. I mean, not like people talk about it for the performance aspects, for increased fat burning and using more fat as a source of energy and so on. But like, even if we look at it from the social aspect, the fact that you can't have any carbohydrates, maybe you can get away with like one glass of wine. You know, it's so restrictive on your diet that, you know, socially it's just going to be super difficult, and it's going to ostracize yourself, and we'll also start to relate to, I think, also poor habits with food, which is also what I believe about certain intermittent fasting kind of things, where if you reduce your feeding window to like 6 hours or something, you know, doing like an 18-6 fasting, you're promoting like binge eating.
Yeah.
You know, and you're saving those calories for a specific time period, and then eating them all at once. The next mistake I had was high fat food on the bike.
Yeah.
This is like people having like peanut butter sandwiches, having nuts, having like energy bars, you know, carb bars or whatever, with loads of nuts in or loads of chocolate on. Or oat bar. There's so many bars out there, like I could list loads.
It's quite common in quite a lot of brands that are got surprisingly high fat.
Yeah, like I can list you at least 3 bars right now that have about 10 to 13 grams of fat. And you know, if you had, and they're only going to have between what, 25 and 30 grams of carbs, maybe a bit more, maybe more up to like, I know one of them has like 40 grams. And but like, you have one of those, that's not even an hour's worth of carbs, really. And that's 10 grams of fat. So like, if you look at recommended amounts of fat per day, which is, you know, about 0.6 grams per kilogram body weight, it's not much. That's for a normal individual. And then it might go up a little bit more for an exercising individual. You know, that amount of fat is huge. You have 3 bars, that's 30 grams of fat, which is going to be most like over half most people's daily requirement for fat.
Yeah.
Just on a bike ride. That's not even helping performance. Like, that fat's not going to do anything for you. It's, you know, it might add flavor maybe, or texture, but it's not improving your performance. You know, only carbohydrate will improve performance on the bike. So, yeah, it's a bit of an interesting one. I think a lot of people maybe make that mistake to having a huge amount of calories not from carbohydrate whilst on the bike. And the last one.
Yeah, we're 4 now, aren't we? I was just trying to think in my head.
Yeah, the last one was not practicing, which, you know, we've spoken about for your 24 hour, and yeah, it's constantly always the same mistake. Practice race day nutrition. If you're going to go and do the ETAP, it's going to take you 11 hours or however long, you know, get out on some of your big rides and practice what you're going to do race day. Practice that carb load. Don't get there to your event the day before and just be like, oh, I'm going to have this pizza, I'm going to have this dessert, I'm going to have all these foods that I never have. And then you wake up next morning, you're bloated, you end up having the worst GI distress, you feel awful. And it's all because, like, you go there and you have foods that you never have. And, you know, especially when the amount of stress and the nerves and the adrenaline that's pumping through you, you think having, you know, all these rich foods and foods you're not used to is going to be ideal when, if anything, your stomach's more sensitive than ever. You've just finished a massive block. You've just finished 6 months worth of training for this event, and you go and blow it because you had like a steak and ice cream the day before.
And you see that so much, so yeah, much.
So much.
Oh, man. I mean, I know it from like friends of mine who would like night before an event, I'm like, I just want something simple, like a nice simple bowl of pasta or something, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, I can't remember when it was, but I remember going out and I can't remember where we were. I think it was like in France or something for a race or something like that. And some of the other guys were like ordering these massive steaks and chips and like, yeah, having like, you know, just like fucking huge, like, lumps of like meat, rich flavors and things like that. And I remember just thinking, yeah, you're always going to shit that out in the morning, or you're going to need to shit that out in the middle of the day. Neither of them are good for tomorrow.
I mean, red meat's known to take longer to digest. It's going to make you feel heavier. It's going to make you feel bloated in the morning. You know, I wouldn't have any red meat 2 or 3 days before the event.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people get issues related to fiber as well. You know, you definitely want to be running like lower fiber, looking more to your high GI white-based carbohydrates, because one, they are lower in fiber anyway, but also they store more effectively in the 24 hours before a race.
Mm. So what would you say? So white GI, that's like white bread, yeah?
Yeah, white bread, white rice. Looking at, you know, other things like crumpets, I guess, like this, rice pudding. You know, foods like this, quick cook oats will come under that, but we'll have a bit more fiber in. Yeah. And then also looking at other options, like, you know, drinks are often forgotten. Like, drinks are a great source of carbohydrate, whether you're using maltodextrin to mix in some water, or, you know, a couple of like San Pellegrinos or, you know, Fanta or something over the day. It's not, you know, I think a lot of people mix up the idea of like, you know, pre-race day carb loading. You know, it is sports specific. It's not about a day really about enjoying yourself or binge eating or something like this. It's very specific. It's very related to that next day event. And, you know, you can do it in really obviously healthy ways. I'm not advocating a day of Haribo by any means. Some of that might be fine. You know,
it would be a great day to have though. That would be.
Yeah. But like, you know, a bit of that is fine. But, you know, you look at all the, obviously, they're Michelin star chefs and stuff that like Ineos and EF have to make. But, you know, there are great recipes you can have out there to make that are fitting that bill. You know, having some, you know, stewed apple with some like honey mixed into that, something like this as a dessert to go with maybe some rice pudding or something like that after your meal, which was a maybe rice-based meal or some rice noodles or something like this, are the things that you're looking more towards on that kind of day.
I'm salivating right now. So I got a question for you.
Yes.
So on your where is my tab? So on your website, willburning.com, yeah?
Yep.
You have tons of recipes on there, yeah?
I do indeed, yeah.
And which is fantastic, but anyone that's looking for like I'm trying to get onto it now, I'm trying to multitask and failing. For anyone that's looking at like for some examples of food, the sort of stuff we're discussing about, if you just go onto the latest tab and go to recipes, there's a section which is just called Epic Food. And they're like, we talked earlier about the ice cream that I made, like sorbet.
Yeah.
It's on there, banana bread, energy bar stuff. Like, and there's a good mix of like vegetarian and like vegan and meat lover, gluten free stuff. Like, there's always there. It's a really good mix of stuff on there. So it's a really good source to go to. And I've used it quite a lot for different things. How about this though? A cookbook that you'd recommend for people that are looking for like more examples, say they've cooked everything on your website and they're looking for something else.
Yeah, that's a good one. I quite like, I'm a big fan of Roy Choi. He's the guy that did that Netflix TV show with Jon Favreau. He's quite, does like a Mexican fusion kind of food a lot. And then you've also got the, what's that book by Feed Zone? I think has some recipes, and I'm actually a really big fan of Nigel Mitchell, who's obviously the EF nutritionist who's brought me into EF. His vegan book is a great read, The Plant-Based Cyclist, which is out through GCN. It's a really good book because I think that book in itself is very standalone. Like, it is all plant-based meals, but they're great meals. They're very quick. They're very easy. There's a lot of good information in there. And he all the stuff that he talks about in there is just stuff that you can, you know, apply to yourself as your own, you know, not being a plant-based cyclist. I think it's information, you know, for everyone.
Quite a useful one for people that are interested in that side of it as well, I guess.
Yeah, one of them, one book that I'd recommend that isn't like a proper cookbook, but it's in the thing that you want to talk about at the end, which is the top five life hacks or tips. So I'll save it for then.
Nice. I remember, I'm just looking through some of your recipes now, and when we were in Calpe, you did the banana curry.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's a pretty special meal, that. Like,
yeah. Banana curry is a great one.
Mate, banana curry is exceptional. Like, if anyone wants a tip of a meal to try, go to try the banana curry on the website. Like, big fan of that. The one that I'm really keen to do at some point is the lime and coconut cheesecake.
Yeah, that's good with the avocado base. It's surprisingly good.
Yeah, and it is more the colour than anything that I want to try with it. I love the colour of it. It's a really rich green colour. I go to it all the time. It's a really useful like source of knowledge as well. So you've already like led onto it as provisionally. I'm gonna now get you to do your five hacks and tips.
Yeah, for sure. So my first one, you know, for the last couple of years for me, and I think we probably didn't talk about it that much at the beginning, but, you know, my crash was really significant and really big. And it's interesting because initially after the crash, like I didn't think much about it or of it in some ways, which sounds maybe a bit bizarre. You know, it's really easy in my mind to be focused on just fixing myself and to just crack on, you know, like I was like, oh, I'm broken, I'll fix it. You know, and it's such a like a, you know, a direct way of thinking about it. But, you know, subsequently, and as I've told you, you know, in December just last year, probably something that has been, you know, left and kind of steadily getting worse over a period of time from my crash, which had left me, I guess, very, you know, dysfunctional, I guess, in some ways with like the amount of injuries I had, I ended up slipping a disc. And, it's a long way round to go into to saying something about like, you know, reaching out to people and, you know, asking for help and just talking about it. And I think too many people stay quite insular and worry about maybe, I don't know, burdening other people with their problems and, you know, not necessarily even like putting it on social media. I think I only did a few posts about my crash on social media, but, you know, I spent a lot of time reaching out to people that really mattered to me about my crash and just talking to them and getting that help. You know, I really struggled since slipping a disc in December, suddenly had a lot of things taken from me again. And I really struggled and I had a lot of depression for like 2 months. And, you know, talking to people and telling people I'm struggling, you know, and I think that's a big one where people really don't say, you know, they might message someone saying, you know, just trying to start a conversation saying, how you doing, and waiting for that response of someone being to ask them how they are. But, you know, the amount of times you just write, yeah, I'm okay, or something like this, like, you know, to really say, you know, I'm really fucking struggling, can make a difference sometimes, you know. So
it's quite poignant as well that this is, we're recording this this week, this right now, when it is Mental Health Awareness Week in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, it's really apt then, isn't it, to be honest?
Yeah. Both of us are two people that have struggled in the past with that quite a lot, definitely, and still do to some points. And you're completely right, being able to, sometimes it's quite hard to do.
Yeah.
But really, accepting that you need to reach out is very important. And it can, as you say, it can be, it doesn't have to be like anything big. It just is, it can be something quite small, really. Like,
yeah, for sure. Like, it can be really tough, I think. I think maybe more for blokes, but I'm just saying that because I am a bloke, I guess. But to share those feelings can be quite tough, maybe seen as a weakness or something like this, when you're meant to be, you know, invert commas, men, which, you know, isn't great connotations or stereotypes. And definitely, it's really helped me, you know, being able to just talk about those things and just share them. Something like I think a lot of it is you just need to rant. You're not looking for advice sometimes. And this is, you know, this is something that is interesting about my crash, was that I wasn't looking for advice from people. You know, as hard as it may be to say or to explain, like, nobody really knows what it's like to be hit by a lorry, to have everything broken in your body, to, you know, subsequently have died in surgery, and then to come back from that. Like, nobody really knows what that's like unless you've obviously had it yourself. And, you know, you're not looking for someone to be like, you know, silver linings and shit like this. You just want someone to listen to you.
And yeah.
Just to know that, yeah, you're struggling or you're hurting. And that makes a big difference. It really does.
Definitely. And how are you feeling now about everything? Like, I know you've been doing a lot of sort of support with fixing your back up as well. How's everything kind of going with that now?
Yeah, really good. Like, you know, it turns out like the disc that I slipped subsequently was a case of things that were left untreated from my crash, and eventually it just kind of went. And you know, I'm really focusing on that, and it's looking pretty hopeful that I could give bike riding a go again, which, you know, I'd love more than anything if I can get on my bike and ride, because I haven't really been able to. I did initially, but I was having too many physical issues. Some of them obviously I've told you about. It was too much, you know, too much anxiety, too much discomfort whilst riding my bike. So, you know, hopefully that'll come, you know, come back. And when I initially had the depression from like December onwards, when I did the disc, I did end up seeing a therapist from the end of January, which did help a bit, you know, just talking about it a bit more with someone, which I definitely think it, you know what, like that therapist didn't give me any advice or anything, which is why I think reaching out is so important. If you have people you can reach out to and fully talk about those feelings, it's exactly what a therapist does. It's what you pay for. You pay for someone to listen to your problems, you know, without any thoughts to give, you know, as an independent person. And I think it kind of leads on to my next point, which is, you know, something that I retrospectively have, you know, thought, you know, people have asked me before, you know, what it makes you look at life differently, kind of thing, after something like that. And I think the biggest one was just making time. You know, we're all busy, we all have busy lifestyles, but making time just to message someone can make a difference. Making time to see that person, making time to not be on your phone when you're with someone, are all big things. It's all pretty deep stuff, but, like, you know, it's all stuff I've learned, you know.
I think you and I have very similar sentiments on this kind of stuff. Like, I completely agree with everything you're saying, like 100%. I mean, you know, there's points when I just don't reply to messages, for example, because I literally don't go near my phone. And then you get a reply like a day later, and it's just like, oh, he's just gone off the radar for a while. I completely agree with you with the reaching out thing. And I used to see a therapist as well, like, and she was incredibly good, as you say, at being a neutral person to listen to effectively me venting and getting things off my chest. And I, as you say, like, that's basically what you pay a therapist for, and they're very good at listening, long and short of it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the making time thing, like, I 100% agree with that. Like, it's a lot of people, like, I like ask me about how I juggle so much, and it's just being very strict to it. Like, you know, I get up at 5:30 pretty much every day, apart from today. Because I, like, I text you, I was like, dude, I need a line.
I mean, that really aptly goes into my next one, because, you know, I inverted commas, you saw it. You know, I put, I wish. And the amount of people that say similar about how do you get time for all these things? Because, you know, I have a lot of other hobbies. You know, I paint, I play the guitar, I learn languages, things like this, or try to anyway. And, you know, and if you find, I think one thing is, like, if you find yourself saying, I wish for something, like, I very much stop myself and go, do I really wish for that? Am I just saying that, you know? And it was like, for me in the guitar, I was like, I found myself saying one day, I wish I could play guitar. And I was like, if I really wish that, why don't I just go buy a guitar and start learning? Because for the sake of what? Half an hour a day, maybe an hour if you're really dedicated, you can learn something new. And that's kind of crazy when you think about it. You know, we mentioned about time in your day, and we've mentioned about, you know, you've got 24 hours, and obviously maybe you sleep for 7 or 8. And there's loads of other motivational people that talk about this, but, like, for the sake of half an hour a day, you can learn a new skill. And I'm not saying you need to learn every new skill out there, but if you do find yourself saying, I wish for something, really, do you really wish for it? And if you do, cool, spend some time on it, you know?
I love that.
Yeah.
It's a really good one. Yeah, that's a really, really good one.
The next one I had was what we're relating to about other recipe books and things. It's probably like my Bible for cooking.
Yeah.
Which is Flavor Thesaurus. Now, I've actually forgotten the name of the author, so I'm going to quickly Google that for you. But Flavor Thesaurus is the name of it. And it's essentially a book that talks about flavor combinations and how they mix together. So it's by Nikki Segnet.
Yeah, I've just Googled it as well. It's going straight in my Amazon basket as I speak.
So it's literally like, it looks like a pie chart flavor wheel, but it divides flavors into, like, woody, forest, creamy, floral, fruity, all these kinds of things. And then when you go through the book, it will pick maybe an ingredient within one of those. You know, let's think about, like, coconut. And then it will tell you different flavors that go with coconut. And now, I think this is a big one for me and about cooking, and especially when people, like, that come up so often, they say, I don't know what to cook. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know meal ideas. I don't know recipes. And if you think about flavors instead, flavors are so much easier.
Yeah.
Because you can go around a supermarket and just think about flavors. And if you know what flavors go with things, you can just go, oh, you know, I'll have that and that, and it will taste good because those flavors go together. They're not opposing anymore.
Nice.
It's so much easier to create recipes on the fly to do that. You know, if you've got a bunch of seasonings and herbs and so on like this, just bang them together. You know, obviously honey and soy sauce is, like, a famous one, isn't it?
Oh, bad.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you can really easily just bang some salmon in a pan with some honey and some soy sauce. You're going to give it a glaze. Amazing.
That's... Do you know one of the things I'm obsessed with at the moment?
What?
Miso paste.
Yeah, miso is nice.
Oh, God. You
know?
Yeah.
And it's stuff like that where you suddenly know that combination, and there's a bunch of combinations in there like that where you can just grab and it's a go-to. And I love that, you know.
Nice. I've just ordered that book, by the way.
It's definitely a good one.
Nice, awesome. Okay, so we are on number five? Number five, yeah.
Yes, so the last one is my favourite word. And it's, I guess, more of a philosophical thing to maybe leave people thinking rather than, and it's something I contemplate maybe quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's the word sonder, spelled S-O-N-D-E-R. And it's the profound feeling of realizing that everyone, including strangers passing the street, has a life as complex as one's own, which they're constantly living despite one's personal lack of awareness of it.
Mm-hmm.
Definition. And I think it's just the idea that everyone has a completely unique and, yeah, complex and diverse life of their own. And, yeah, it's just something that I contemplate quite a lot.
I really like that one, because one of the things that something that my dad always said to me as well was like, just remember that, he's like, if someone's like really horrible to you, like, try and think why they're being horrible.
Yeah,
like, there's got to be something that's affecting, there's got to be a reason to it. Like, it must be like something that might have happened in their own personal life or to them, you know, in a day, like, I don't know what it could be. Like, it could be anything of the scale. Yeah. Of, it could be someone's passed away, or they went to the shops and they were sold out of flour, for example.
Which could be a regular, that happens to me right so now. Much in lockdown.
Yeah. And, I really like that one, because I feel that it's something that a lot of people look inwards at themselves going, oh, you know, the problem is me. But actually, in reality, you need to look outwards and open your eyes up and understand that someone else might be being, like, as you say, they might have something going on external that's much more tricky to understand. So it's just being, you know, kind of accepting it, isn't it, if that makes sense?
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
And relating to other humans and realizing that we're all legends and bellends in exactly the same second, if that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh man, oh, there's some really, 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 really good tips.
Yeah, really deep ones. Not exactly the jokiest bunch, but yeah.
No, but that's a good thing. I think that's a really good thing, because, like, you're a human who I have a lot of respect for anyway, who's done a lot of stuff and always very, you know, I think it's very important to surround yourself with people that inspire you in their own way as well, and that's my kind of like love to you as a person, is that you're a very inspiring person. And
thank you very much, man.
I don't give a shit what people think about me saying that, it's the truth, so fuck you, motherfuckers. I feel like this particular episode will be very interesting for a lot of people on a number of senses, because we've covered a shit ton of stuff. What I really wanted to kind of get across is that behind, ultimately, is who's an incredible nutritionist and very intelligent human being, there's an equally fascinating person as well, which maybe doesn't always come across. And I thought I wanted to try and get some of that out of you.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. I think, you know, like you said, with the nutrition and stuff, more than welcome to head down to what I'm now doing, is the YouTube channel, and talking about papers that I read and just breaking them down and making them easy. So it was nice to talk about, I guess, myself for once in a different way.
Yeah, amazing. Right, I'm going to wrap it up, and I'm going to spend my afternoon building a bicycle.
Okay. Awesome.
What are you going to do this afternoon?
I'm going to go for a stroll. I'm going to do my rehab that I have to do every day, and just take it easy, I think.
Amazing. Well, thank you very much for your time, Will. And I'll probably talk to you in like 5 seconds when I stop recording.
Yeah, nice one. Thanks very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.